Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. Did you know you could get CDs from us and listen to a year's worth of Real Science Friday shows on one CD? It is so much fun. In fact, I'm holding in my hand the Real Science Friday 2011 CD. It's an MP3 CD. You can get the MP3 CD, play it in an MP3 player, or even play it in a DVD player or your computer. So you can get it for 2011, 2010, all the way back to 2006. If you'd like, Real Science Friday shows convenient on a single MP3 CD, and it'll support the airing of Real Science Friday. So just call us at 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278, or go online, realsciencefriday.com, and click on the store. And of course, that'll help us continue to broadcast. May God bless you. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. Fred Williams is on assignment. 1 year ago, Christianity Today published a cover story, The Search for the Historical Adam. This is Christianity Today. It indicated the state of liberal Christianity in America as it denied the existence of a literal Adam and Eve. And so instead of acknowledging the truth of God's word, they went with a bizarre idea from old earth Christians that God put human souls into perhaps a couple hundred or a couple thousand animals that had evolved from ape-like creatures. This creates serious scientific and biblical problems. And to help us think through these issues, we have Dr. Georgia Purdom, who earned a PhD in molecular genetics from Ohio State University and is a scientist at Answers in Genesis. Dr. Purdom, welcome to Real Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what an honor to have you on the show. You've authored multiple papers in peer-reviewed journals, including the Journal of Neuroscience. So you're qualified to speak to the issues of genetics, but I know also that you study the scriptures. And so, Georgia, can you explain to us, what did you think when you first saw this article?
When I first saw it, in some ways, I wasn't surprised because this has become a real debate in evangelical Christianity today, because for whatever reason, a lot of theologians are really buying into a lot of what these scientists are saying, scientists that, again, are supposedly Christians, professing Christians. They're buying into what they're saying about how genetics basically makes it impossible for there to be just two people that all of us have descended from. So I think it's just an outcome, so to speak, of that belief and what's been going on in Christianity today.
You have specialized in cellular biology. You've been a professor yourself. Later in the program, I'd like to get to the work of Answers in Genesis, what you're doing there, what's coming up with Ken Ham's ministry. We've had him in studio on this program a couple times, although some years ago. So we're excited about all that. But could we start with a discussion of the genetics? Because these scientists tell the Christian public, well, molecular biology has proven that we've not come from two individuals. So let's start there.
Okay.
Why do they say that? Is that a valid assessment?
They say that based on a couple of different lines of quote-unquote evidence. One of them being the idea of mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam, and then another one being the genetic diversity that we have in humans today.
Mm-hmm.
So starting with the whole idea of mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam, so what they'll say is that we can look at the mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome DNA in humans today, and we can determine from that that our ancestors, so to speak, our female ancestor lived approximately 200,000 years ago, and our male ancestor lived approximately 142,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is in no way reference to a biblical Adam and Eve, or even just two people, because they didn't live at the same time.
Right.
So they would say they were just from a group of people, and for whatever reason, their mitochondrial DNA and their Y chromosome DNA still exist in us today.
And if this is true, then, of course, the biblical chronology would be false.
Right.
And so we look closely at these claims.
And what we see when we look at those claims is they're using what they call a molecular clock. And without going into a lot of the nitty-gritty details on that, it's basically just a way to supposedly look at the differences in mitochondrial DNA or Y chromosome DNA from one generation to the next and come up with an idea of how fast this clock supposedly ticks. The problem is the clock is not an independent measure of time. Hmm. So just like if you have a wristwatch and you are trying to calibrate it, okay, and determine the time, you look at another clock and you get that time. Well, if that time is wrong, then your watch is going to be wrong.
Hmm.
It's the same way with the mitochondrial and Y chromosome DNA molecular clocks, because they are making certain assumptions to determine how fast the clock ticks. So they're making an assumption, for example, that chimps and humans share a common ancestor. They're making an assumption that the DNA mutation rate doesn't vary over time. And if that doesn't work, sometimes they'll say, well, it was slow at one point and fast at another point.
Mm-hmm.
They assume that radiometric dating of rock layers and the fossils that are in them, they assume that all of that is accurate. So they're making all these assumptions. And if those assumptions are wrong, guess what? The molecular clock is wrong. So you're going to get a wrong date.
I've read some of the papers, I think, in Science and in Nature that talk about the mitochondrial Eve, the dating of this molecular clock, and they talk about recalibrating the mitochondrial clock and so on. Let me ask you if my observation, I'm not a scientist, I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, I'm a talk show host, so easily I could misunderstand something, but let me ask you if this is correct or if you could correct this. It seems to me that when they try to date how long ago the first woman lived that we've all descended from, they make an assumption that we have evolved from chimpanzees or we had a mutual ancestor with chimpanzees. And so they incorporate chimpanzee genetic data into their calculations. But right. When they looked at exclusively human genetic data and human documented mutation rates, they came out with this famous saying from Ann Gibbons in Science that Eve would have lived a mere 6,000 years ago. And of course, they can't let that stand. But that's when they omitted their chimp DNA analysis and just looked at the human DNA. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, there have been other analyses, though. We have to be a little bit careful with using that particular data. We don't want to cherry pick data because there have been other papers and things that have been produced, and they give a wide range for mitochondrial Eve, depending on, like you say, the assumptions that they use. And so some of them are even human-human, and it really depends on the part of the mitochondrial DNA that you look at because, for example, the regulatory region in the mitochondrial DNA mutates a lot faster than the other parts of the DNA. So it really depends on what you look at for the answers you get. So I've seen papers where she ranges anywhere from 6,000 years to 200 and a lot of different dates in between.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what it really shows us is that, first of all, molecular clocks are all over the place. They're not solid grounds for saying, well, she's this old or she's this old, because they change all the time. Why do chromosome Adam, up until like just a couple years ago, he was only 60,000 years old. Now he's 142,000 years old.
Mm.
So it just shows you all the problems that there are with molecular clocks for using them for this type of analysis. But we can say that because of the low level of variation that is found among women today and their mitochondrial DNA and men today and their Y chromosome DNA, that very little time has passed between us and our most recent common ancestor, which is Adam and Eve.
And I think there's something similar with cosmology. Probably every 15 years for the last century, the universe has gotten about 500 million years older. Mm-hmm. And so we see these numbers all over the map with trying to date the human race genetically. Dr. Purdom, there are different geochronometers, ways to date the age of the Earth, just like different ways of looking at DNA and seeing, well, this part mutated, it could have done it in only thousands of years, this part in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. It seems that often that these tests are indicators of the oldest maximum possible age. So that if you look at all the sediments in the bottom of the ocean, you say, well, those sediments could have built up in X number of years, and that sort of gives you an upper limit. And if you look at how much helium's in the atmosphere, or how much volcanic rock is on the surface of the Earth, or how much nickel's in the crust of the Earth, each of these give you, well, that much nickel could have come to the Earth from meteorites over X number years. They each sort of give you a maximum oldest age. And so the youngest ones tend to prevail because there could have been a lot of nickel on the Earth to begin with. But if it all came from outer space, then it's X number of years old. Well, might that be true with genetics also? If we look at this region of DNA and we say, well, that variation could have come from mutation over 5 million years. But we look at this big chunk, say, of the Y chromosome, and they say, wow, we're not finding the variation we thought. You'd have this much variation just in 20,000 years. Wouldn't the younger date be the one logically that would tend to prevail?
It might be logically, but people a lot of times are illogical when it comes to this because
right.
They know if they go with the lower numbers, then it's just going to give more support to the biblical ideas, and they don't want to do that.
Now, how about Y chromosomal Adam? Isn't it true that there have been studies where they would take a chunk of the Y chromosome and take living human beings from around the world, some dozens of them, and expect to find dramatic differences, and they end up being astounded by how similar they are? In one study, if I recall, they didn't find a single difference in one region of the Y chromosome.
That's true. It's just like for mitochondrial Eve. They're not finding a lot of variation. And if their time frames are right, there should be a lot more variation, a lot more. They cannot account for the low level of variation with their time frames. But with the biblical time frame, it totally is consistent with that.
So Christianity Today coming out and saying, well, the scientific evidence is in. There is proof that we did not come from two individuals, a man and a woman, so we have to reinterpret the Bible. In that article that they printed, it seems like they didn't really give the scientific evidence to counter that claim.
And when I read the article, a lot of it's mainly liberal theologians giving their take on this. And again, they're just kind of buying into what a lot of the, unfortunately, liberal Christian scientists have said about this. I mean, I'm not expecting the theologians to read the scientific papers necessarily, but really looking at it from both sides, what I really want people to understand is there are so many assumptions that are made in all of these calculations, these clocks, whatever they're doing, that are evolutionary in nature, that they've already basically said, well, we're starting with the assumption that these things are correct, and we're basing our calculations off of that. Well, it's just like with radiometric dating. If your assumptions are incorrect to start with about the past, then you're going to end up with an incorrect conclusion today. So that's what people really need to realize is for all the scientific stuff that's out there is that really have to evaluate what are the assumptions that the scientists are making, because that is going to have a direct bearing on the numbers or whatever they get and the conclusions that they draw from that.
Well, for example, at Chicago's Field Museum, one of the world's most beautiful museums, they've got, in fact, the largest T-Rex there, not a cast, the actual fossil. And when all the reports started surfacing of Dr. Mary Schweitzer and others finding soft tissue, in fact, even in a T-Rex fossil, lo and behold, they broke open a bone from Sue, the T-Rex they have there in their lobby, and they found original biological material that's now been published. I know that the scientist at Creation Research Society Kevin Anderson and Mark Armitage went up to the Hell Creek Formation in Montana. They spent a day digging out a Triceratops horn, and they broke it open, and sure enough, using an electron microscope, they got photographs of osteocytes. This is preliminary. We interviewed them a couple weeks ago, but it looks like soft tissue. So the assumptions going in that we would never find soft tissue in dinosaur fossils. So for a century, nobody looked.
Right.
And now that we realize that that assumption led to a scientifically false conclusion, now everybody wants to get in on the game. So what false assumptions have there been that these liberal theologians are buying into? I think that they're excited to have a scientific argument to say that Genesis is not literally true.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's very unfortunate that they've already made the decision what they don't believe and do believe about the Bible. And so now this is just the, so to speak, the science to uphold it. But what they really need to realize is how inconsistent the science is with evolutionary ideas, but is absolutely consistent with the Bible.
Can we take a moment, talk about Answers in Genesis and some of your work? And then I'd like to get back to this issue and discuss a little bit more about the genetics of Adam and Eve and what scientists are finding generally in the genomes of species around the world, and then also some of the biblical implications of if Adam and Eve were not actual historical persons. But how about Answers in Genesis, Georgia? What's happening there at AIG?
Well, we are entering our very busy season at the Creation Museum right now, and so we're very excited about that and seeing all the different people and families coming in. And we have a lot of programs that we're running throughout the summer, and if people go to either answersingenesis.org or creationmuseum.org, they can find out more information about all the different activities that we have going on this summer. Mm. Answers in Genesis is also having a family conference in Branson, Missouri this year called Proclaiming the Faith, and again, you can get on the Answers in Genesis website to find out about that. I'm really excited about that conference. It's really for the whole family. There's a children's track, a teen track, a women's track. And so there really is something for everybody at that conference.
Well,
so that's just a few of the things that we're busy with this summer. But I also want to mention, too, that we are starting a project called the Ark Encounter to build the biblically sized ark.
That is so exciting. We've reported on this, and so I'd love to hear an update. How's the project going?
Well, the project is going well, and obviously, you know, there's always the fundraising aspects, Denise, that we need to have the money to be able to do it. We have secured all of the land for the project. It's about 45 minutes south of the Creation Museum in Williamstown, Kentucky, and people can find out more information by going to arkencounter.org to see updates on different things that are occurring and our fundraising and just how to partner with us to make this a reality, because we believe this is a very evangelistic opportunity that we have to help people know that God's word is true and the importance of receiving Christ as their Savior.
Now, a biblically sized ark, this is an enormous structure. It would mean that Answers in Genesis is building about a 2 football field long vessel. Is that about the size of the ark?
Yes. And it's going to be an entirely wooden structure, just like Noah's was.
Wow. That is so very exciting. You have a DVD that I just love, The Code of Life, DNA Information and Mutation. And I believe that you're working on some new DVDs, or are there others that are newly published?
There are others that are out there. I have one called The Wonder of the Cell that looks at the intricacies of the cell. I have one called All Creatures Great and Small, Microbes in Creation, looking at bacteria and their role in creation in God's world. And then I have another one called Most Asked Questions, Genetics, Evolution, and Creation. So it goes into some information about mitochondrial Eve and things like mutation, beneficial mutations, gene duplications, a little bit more technical topics there. And then I have another one just released for parents to really help them educate themselves on how to equip their kids to understand the Bible when it comes to the most asked questions by kids. Mm. And so they can find all of those on the Answers in Genesis website.
Well, that is just great. You know, I had forgotten about Wonder of the Cell. I've seen that. That is a fabulous DVD. And as far as the conference in Branson, Missouri, that's just a fun place to bring your family to start with. So that's super, the AIG Family Conference there this summer. And then the museum, Georgia. I've been there a couple times. We've brought our family. Just an absolutely beautiful museum. In fact, it's a state-of-the-art museum. It gives glory to God. It's so refreshing. It's just a thrill. I couldn't recommend more strongly people going to the Creation Museum.
Especially this time of year, everything is blooming in our garden. So it's pretty amazing to see all of that out there. And we have a baby wallaby that's been added to our petting zoo. So a lot of things to see.
Well, that sounds just great. Okay, so now if we could get back to some of the genetics and the claims, I have a couple questions. One has to do with all the genomes that have been published lately. We've been following this on Real Science Friday, and it seems that time after time, scientists who are leading the project, say, to sequence the kangaroo genome down in Australia, or the Great Barrier Reef sponge, or the gorilla DNA, or the roundworm, and on, the mouse DNA, when they make their public pronouncements, they always have a similar aspect to them. They say, we're shocked, we're surprised that we're finding a huge chunk of the human genome in the kangaroo genome, that the sponge DNA, 70% of the genes that code for proteins in sponges are the same as the genes in humans, and those include genes for building nerves and muscles, things that sponges don't have. So there's been an article recently in New Scientist where they quote many, many evolutionary geneticists saying that we can no longer defend a hierarchical evolutionary tree of life because we're finding everything everywhere it's not supposed to be. Is that generally accurately representing that picture?
Yes, I think it is. And if you think about it, I mean, it really makes sense in some ways, because especially when you're looking at the genes that encode the proteins, I mean, if you look at a kangaroo and a human being, I mean, we're both mammals. And so we both have the same basic bodily functions, even though we look very different, the same types of biochemistry and things like that have to be carried out in our cells and for life. And so it's not surprising that you're finding a lot of the similarities. And even if you go down to, say, a fruit fly or a sponge or any of these things, I mean, there are just basic things that are needed for life that no matter what type of organism that you have, they have to have the same information. I think where a lot of the differences we're really going to start seeing, and as they explore this more, it's what they're finding is there's really differences in what they call the junk DNA,
right,
which really isn't junk, but it has a lot of regulatory functions. And so I think that's where we're going to start seeing more and more of the differences. They haven't studied it up to this point because, again, because of their evolutionary assumptions, it's supposedly just junk left from our evolutionary leftovers, but obviously that's not the case. And so there is a need to really study that in more detail.
Well, the roundworm, which is one of the simplest, there's no such thing as simple life. A single cell is wildly complex, but comparatively, one of the simplest species on Earth, human beings have about 20,000 genes. The roundworm, C. elegans, if I pronounce it right, has 19,000 genes, and that surprised the Darwinist. And to find genes in sponges that in humans build nerves and muscles, and a sponge doesn't have these things, it seems like the creator had a genetic toolbox or a blueprint, and he started with that, and he said, from this, I think I'll build a banana and a robin and an apple tree. And started with another toolbox, and he built a kangaroo and a mouse and a person from these generic toolboxes of DNA code.
I think that's true. And two, in some ways, I'm really thankful and grateful for that because it allows us to study and understand these things. Because if they were all very drastically different, it would be very difficult for us to study one thing and understand that might apply to something else, or how we can study diseases, for example, human diseases in mice, because mice and humans are so similar. So it allows us to really explore and understand the world around us by having those types of similarities.
Dr. Purdom, you wrote a great article that appeared recently in Answers Magazine on cavemen, and my co-host Fred Williams, he's the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. He's a software engineer, and he's a really good sport. So he and I dressed up as cavemen, took a publicity shot at our Red Rocks Park here in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And in your article, you wrote something that was just so powerful. pointing out that Neanderthal DNA, now that it has been sequenced, has been shown to be remarkably similar to my producer, Daryl Berkey, to his DNA, to my DNA. And you said it's even closer to modern human DNA than a chimp's is to another chimp's. Could you explain that?
Well, it's just known that if you compare two chimp genomes, same species and all, that they have more variety, more differences. And in fact, it's not just true for chimps. It's also true for other organisms. You know, if you compare any two fruit flies or any two whatever you want to pick, there's a lot of other animals and organisms you can choose that you'll see a lot more differences between any two individuals than you do in humans. It's much more conserved for whatever reason. Again, indicating that we all come from, again, an ancestor really not that long ago, within the biblical time frame of just several thousand years ago.
Mm. We're almost out of time. The biblical implications of saying that there is no Adam and Eve never existed as two people. What are the biblical implications? Because it seems that this will go far beyond Adam and Eve, that there are ramifications to this claim.
And that's absolutely correct. And that is probably the thing that concerns me the most about this whole argument and this whole debate over Adam and Eve is, what does this do to the gospel? Because as Christians, that's what we really should be focusing on and should be living out in our lives and helping other people understand. So when all of a sudden you say that Adam and Eve are not real historical people who lived and supposedly didn't do what the Bible said they did, they didn't commit the first sin, then where does that leave the work of Jesus Christ? Because the reason that Jesus Christ had to come to earth as a man in the first place was because of what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. Because they existed and they sinned, we need Jesus Christ. Paul refers to him as the last Adam. You know, because of what the first Adam did, we need the last Adam. When you take away that historical Adam and Eve and you take away that history in Genesis, you have just done away with the foundation of the gospel. You've done away with the purpose of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
There is a student at a conservative Christian school that contacted us when we did this show, and he said, you know, it's not only Adam and Eve. My professors, who now deny a literal Adam and Eve, they also deny the Bible's teaching of no suffering and death before the fall. They do away with the six literal days of creation. They do away with the global flood. And he said it goes beyond that. For the most part, they reject the Tower of Babel. They reject the fall of Jericho, even the historicity of Joshua's battles. They do away with the book of Jonah. So it is a mindset that has a very low opinion of the reliability of the Bible.
Yes, absolutely. And I always tell people, it's not going to stop in Genesis. I mean, this isn't about Genesis. This is about biblical authority. Mm. And when you take away, when you start taking certain things away, especially such a foundational book like Genesis, then you're saying that the Bible is not authoritative and true in all it says. So it's only a matter of time. You've opened the door a little bit. It's only a matter of time for that door is swung wide open, and you're saying none of it's true.
That's exactly right. Hey, Dr. Georgia Purdom, what an honor to have you on Real Science Friday.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
You're welcome. That was Dr. Georgia Purdom with Answers in Genesis. I strongly recommend her DVDs, The Code of Life, The Wonder of the Cell, All Creatures Great and Small. I'm going to get that one myself. And check out the website, realsciencefriday.com. Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. Did you know you could get and listen to a year's worth of Real Science Friday shows on one CD? It is so much fun. In fact, I'm holding in my hand the Real Science Friday 2011 CD. It's an MP3 CD. You can get the MP3 CD, play it in an MP3 player, or even play it in a DVD player or your computer. So you can get it for 2011, 2010, all the way back to 2006. It'll support the airing of Real Science Friday. So just call us at 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278, or go online, realsciencefriday.com, and click on the store. And of course, that'll help us continue to broadcast. May God bless you.